today. As the Queen gives Harry and Meghan permission to step back as senior royals, we ask what drove the couple to crisis point. And an unprecedented American intervention into the debate over Huawei. Once upon a time, there was a prince. He was handsome, rich, but was sometimes unhappy. But then he met a woman. She was clever, independent, and successful. They fell in love, got married, and everyone was happy, at least for a while.
Harry and Meghan are stepping back from royal life and setting up a new home in North America.
The British royal family is reeling from an extraordinary new rift involving Prince Harry and Meghan Markle.
It's astonishing. It's momentous. It has no precedent in modern times.
On Monday, the Queen released a statement saying she and her family were entirely supportive of Harry and Meghan's desire to create a new life as a young family. Well, when she says entirely supportive, she would have preferred them to remain full-time working members of the royal family. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, where did it all go wrong for Harry and Meghan? Hadley, you're American, but you've spent a lot of time in the UK?
So I moved here with my family when I was 12, I believe.
Hadley Freeman is an opinion writer for The Guardian.
And I went through school and university here and then moved back to the States in my late 20s to work for The Guardian and then came back here again. So very much half and half and dual nationality.
Half and half. Therefore, you've seen the royals through the very different perspectives of Britain and the United States.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, in the US, they are very much seen as celebrities. And that's probably been encouraged by Diana back in her day, who did see herself as a celebrity, I think, and really encouraged that. And here they are seen as almost servants to us. Like, they are obligated to us. We pay them taxes. And also they represent something greater. You know, they are God's representatives on earth, almost, according to some newspapers. So it is a very different attitude. To America, they are the ultimate Kardashians. To Britain, they are the greatest symbols of this country.
What's the difference between a celebrity and a public servant?
Well, obviously, the difference is that one has responsibilities and the other one doesn't. And it seems that Meghan and Harry are very much tempted by the whole celebrity idea that they can use who they are to increase their wealth and have access and to not have these obligations to open leisure centers every weekend. And frankly, who can blame them? Whereas in this country, there's this outrage that people who don't want to be, you know, full-time royals would still have bodyguards, would still get money from the Duchy of Cornwall, all this kind of stuff that people seem very fussed about, which all seems to me slightly a way of expressing outrage that the royals don't want to be royal.
It feels as if this is as much a story about the British media as it is about the royal family.
Well, I think this is a story of the media. And I think what this is really a story of is a divorce between the Windsors and the media. You know, at the beginning of of Elizabeth's reign, she basically had to make a deal with the press at some point. We see this in The Crown, in this series, in the Aberfan episode, when the Queen is ostensibly pushed to go visit Aberfan after the Aberfan disaster by the media. And she does obligatory posing outside and looking sad and holding a rose for the media. And since then, there has been this agreement between the Windsors and the media that the royal family will ostensibly play a bit of a game with them.
And do you find already that Prince William has a will of his own?
Well, he certainly does. I mean, he's a typical three-year-old, because I've worked with three-year-olds.
That they will do what the media wants in exchange for gentle treatment.
Perhaps Harry is more quiet and just watches. Whether he copies William, we wait and see, but he's certainly a different character altogether.
So even when Diana was at her most rebellious and also stepped back a bit in the early 90s, the media gave her a pretty easy time. You know, they said this is Charles's fault, poor Diana. And that is because Diana was still cooperating with the media. She was still giving them stories.
Do you think Mrs. Parker Bowles was a factor in the breakdown of your marriage?
There was the famous Panorama interview.
Well, there were three of us in this marriage, so it was a bit crowded.
you know, most famously, she was talking with Richard Kay from the Daily Mail, who I believe was the royal correspondent, and was meeting him and passing on her stories and giving her side of the story. Now, the difference now is that Meghan and Harry are not doing that. They are not playing that game. And I think a large part of the ire of the media comes from that. They are not giving them anything.
Let's talk about Diana, because I'm sure for you, like for me, the kind of moment that stands out in terms of the royal family over the past few decades is her death. Where were you when she died?
I grew up very close to Kensington Palace. I was at home for the summer holidays from university, and I was at my parents' house, which is about a 8-minute walk from Kensington Gardens. And I looked out my bedroom window and I just saw all these people walking past the window holding flowers. And I had no idea what had happened. I went downstairs and my mom had told me.
This is BBC Television from London. A short while ago, Buckingham Palace confirmed the death of Diana, Princess of Wales.
And so I went to Kensington Gardens with my best friend from university. And we were looking around, and this is 1997, so it was before mobile phones. And at one point, my best friend and I got separated. And so I stood on one of the benches that's right in front of the palace, and I was just sort of looking around for my friend. And this old lady came up to me, and she put her hand on my knee and said, "Are you all right, dear?" And I said, "Oh, I'm fine. I just lost my friend." And she said, "We all have, dear." But yes, that was the big moment. Obviously, that was the most formative thing for Harry. You know, his mother had made this deal with the media. She did play with them. She was on holiday with Dodi Al-Fayed when this crash happened, and she did the deal with them. And still, in Harry's eyes, they killed her. And that was really the end of it for him in the media.
Do you think her experience tells us about the way the royal family treats people who don't conform?
Well, certainly they were not nice to Diana and they were not nice to Sarah Ferguson. You know, there's something to be said about how the royals treat incoming daughters-in-law, which is sort of extraordinary because, you know, Charles didn't even want to marry Diana. He wanted to marry Camilla, as we all know. And it's incredible how horrible the Windsors then were to Diana when she was essentially dragooned into marrying Charles. So they don't like outsiders, even though they make their children marry outsiders, oddly.
And you mentioned that was the kind of big turning point for Harry in terms of his relationship with the media. But there have been other examples that have intensified his dislike of the press.
We all remember the funeral when he, as a 12-year-old, had to walk behind his mother's coffin through the streets of London, watched by millions. It actually kind of makes my spine shiver just thinking about it still. And he has said since in interviews how that would never be allowed today, how this was almost tantamount to cruelty. And I think that did open his eyes to his family. In terms of his relationship with the media, it has always been fraught. As a teenager, photos were flogged of him to the media of him dressed as a Nazi. And of course, he should not have been dressed as a Nazi.
Definitely not.
When he was in the army in Afghanistan, some media outlet published that when we were all supposed to keep it silent. And he then had to be flown home away from the one job he felt he had and where he had a place. And then also the images of him playing naked billiards in Vegas were flogged to the press. And this has made Harry, I think, slightly misunderstand the press. He has a tendency to lump all the media together. And the statement he and Meghan have put out about not dealing with the royal press, well, the truth is the royal press have been pretty kind to him. When we look at coverage of Harry and Meghan, the reporters or the newspapers that are hard on them are sort of the tabloid columnists and the celebrity correspondents. But I think his fury, and it's understandable given how his mother died, is such that he can't really see this issue very clearly.
And you mentioned the crown earlier. The other thing that I found quite striking in this series was the story of Princess Margaret.
Mm. Yeah, definitely.
Like Prince Harry, she's
the spare.
The sibling.
Yeah, the spare.
Is that a difficult role to fulfill?
I think being the spare is an awful role. And I think it is significant that this announcement has come after the very public downfall of Prince Andrew. You know, Harry and Meghan's wedding, for all the fuss around it, was no more significant than Prince Andrew and Sarah Ferguson's wedding. And I'm sure there must be some part of Harry that looks at Prince Andrew and thinks, this is not a future I want, to be this irrelevant, embarrassing old bore going to dinner parties dependent on the kindness of wealthy old ogres. And I'm sure Meghan's looking at Prince Andrew and thinking, I do not want to spend my Christmases with someone who pals around with paedophiles and is accused of sexual abuse himself, which he obviously, I must say, denies. Why should Harry have that role? It's a completely thankless role. Why wouldn't they go off to North America where they could just be celebrities in their own right?
You've talked about women, incoming daughter-in-laws, about Diana and Fergie. But I suppose one thing I just want to point out here is they were British women. For Meghan, she was coming in as a minor celebrity, an actress in suits from the US. I mean, what would her life have been like in the US in that role?
Well, of course, in the US, and I think she was also living in Toronto, she had enormous freedom. She earned a surprising amount from suits. And one of the newspapers said $4 million over the weekend. And she's a young, beautiful woman. I mean, I'm sure she had a terrific life. And she comes over here, she gets engaged to the prince, and she goes to some dinner at the palace. And who's one of the first people she sees? Princess Michael wearing a blackamoor pin. I mean, why would she want to spend her time with these awful people?
And do you know what her perception of joining the royal family would have been?
No, and I think it's interesting that when she did get engaged to the prince, there were lots of dark mutterings in the press about, ooh, she's got her claws in, ooh, now she's going to get her tiara, she's got the fairy tale ending she wants.
I think I can very safely say, as naive as it sounds now, having gone through this learning curve in the past year and a half, I did not have any understanding of just what it would be like.
Turns out she really didn't want that ending. She couldn't give a stuff about the tiaras, and she wants to get the heck out of there.
So how did the British media and the British people react when Harry and Meghan got together?
Well, I think the British public were perfectly happy about it. The British media seemed a bit bemused by it. And there was the infamous column in the Mail on Sunday by Rachel Johnson going on about her exotic DNA and how her spicy blood would thicken the blue, watery Windsor blood. And Harry had to put out an announcement saying, can you please leave her alone and can you stop being also bloody racist?
Didn't say exactly that.
I paraphrased, but I'm sure that the announcement paraphrased Harry's own words, to be honest. And there was a shock that, you know, here is this American mixed race divorcee actress coming in to marry Harry. You know, people were astonished enough by Kate Middleton, who's just this quite sweet, gentle, posh, middle class English girl.
I mean, yeah, let's just remember that for a second.
Middleton has been criticized for her failure to get a real job.
They called her Weighty Katie.
Around, waiting for her prince to pop the question.
And they really did demean her mother for being an air hostess.
And that was sneered at. Well, Meghan is a whole new proposition. You know, people were a bit torn about how to deal with this. She's very beautiful, which always goes down well in the media. But she was a very independent woman who had her own mind and her own career and her own interests.
It's sometimes hard to remember that Kate did get a lot of flack in the first place. Did she do something differently that meant it went away?
What Kate did differently was that she never spoke. So she stayed silent and pretty and adoring of William. And that's all she needed to do. Whereas Diana and now Meghan did not stay silent, and therefore things went bad for them.
I mean, she had been quite outspoken as a feminist. I mean, she'd called Donald Trump a misogynist,
yes,
I think.
Yes, quite.
Do you think she thought she'd be able to use her new role to actually do more of that?
I would imagine she probably did to some extent without thinking about it. I mean, you know, I'm not Meghan's confidant, but I'm sure she thought that this offered her a chance to work with charities that she cared about. And we saw that last week when they released photos of her working with people from Grenfell. So she wanted to do that. I have no doubt that both she and Harry just want to help the causes they care about and not be forced to do the stuff they don't.
And you talk about a difficult start in the media with that statement from Prince Harry, but at the wedding, I mean, people were very happy.
People were very happy. I was at Windsor covering the wedding, and you know, the streets were absolutely packed. The wedding was a bit unusual in some sense, because I believe there was also an American pastor there, and I'm sure we remember some of the glances exchanged by members of the royal family who didn't really know what to do with all this talk of love and sharing your fellow man and stuff that was at the wedding, which was extremely moving.
Love is the only way. There's power in love. Don't underestimate it.
But it was funny because I was outside with the crowd and I could see on Twitter everyone laughing at the kind of sneering glances that the royals were making among themselves. But the crowds outside were just loving it. Like the people around me were just loving this guy and like clapping and singing. So already you could see a slight separation between the royal reaction and the public reaction.
And maybe the point at which things really turned, or at least this is what some would suggest, was the birth of Archie. I mean, they didn't give the media what they had come to expect from a royal birth.
They didn't. They really hid it. We didn't see Archie for several days. We didn't even know when she gave birth. And there was a bit of sneering about that. I would say the turning point, though, also came after the wedding, in that some people who wanted to be invited weren't. And they were outraged by this. The main one being Piers Morgan, who once famously had half a drink with Meghan in a pub.
Who would know that what a fateful night that was, because she went from me here to her first proper date with Prince Harry.
And Meghan left halfway. And Piers seems to think this gives him great insight into what was going on with her and Harry. Anyone else reading that anecdote going, maybe she just didn't like you that much. And before the wedding, Piers wrote this insane article about how Harry had stolen Meghan away from him, but all would be forgiven if he got an invite to the wedding. Well, invite came there none. And since then, he has written countless columns about her, just completely ripping her apart.
I had a bad experience with Meghan Markle. I've talked about it a lot. You know, yep. I just think she's, I'm afraid, a bit of a piece of work.
And encouraging her family to talk about what an awful person she is, mostly her father, Thomas Markle, who has proven his paternal love by constantly slagging his daughter off in the press and to Piers Morgan, and also her sister. And Piers has welcomed them on his TV show, his ITV show, Good Morning Britain. And this was really starting when things began to turn, I think, for Meghan, the way her family were being exploited and welcomed by the British press to slag her off.
So you've just been completely cut off, ghosted.
Ghosted like you, yes.
And the next big point, perhaps, is when she and Prince Harry were on a tour of Africa. Mm-hmm. They were actually travelling with the pack of royal correspondents when they chose to really hit out at the media. Yeah. What happened?
They gave this interview to Tom Bradbury from ITV, who they've been quite close with throughout their marriage, saying how unfair their treatment has been and how that's been hard to accept. And Meghan said that she'd been warned that the British tabloids would ruin her life, and she was kind of now saying that was true.
It's a very real thing to be going through behind the scenes.
And in that interview, Tom Bradbury asked Meghan, "Are you okay?" And she said,
"Thank you for asking, because not many people have asked if I'm okay."
He's since written that it felt as if she was referring to the family.
Yes, I assume she must have told him that, otherwise he's making a massive assumption. And I'm sure no one in the royal family was asking if she's okay. They've all grown up living in this absurd little fishbowl. It wouldn't occur to them that this would be a big adjustment for someone else.
Okay, so that happened. There was a huge feeding frenzy for the press. Things started to die down a bit. They decided to spend Christmas in Canada, mm-hmm. away from the Queen. Mm-hmm. And then they came back and they put out an Instagram post.
After many months of reflection and internal discussions, we have chosen to make a transition this year in starting to carve out a progressive new role within this institution.
Basically suggesting, I think, that they want to half quit the royal family. I mean, what did you make of that?
Interestingly, the palace put out this statement last week to show how much they were trying to help Harry and how unfair Harry and Meghan had been. And they put out a timetable of how things had happened, whereas I think it was 12th of December or something, Harry had asked to see the Queen. And the Queen's secretary replied, "Oh, no, you need to sort this out with Charles first." And then he tried to see his father and his father put him off. And then he tried to see his brother put him off. And then Charles said, "You need to sort this out with your grandmother." And his grandmother said, "You need to sort this out with your father." And just seeing that, it's amazing the palace thought this put the palace in good light, because it actually made the palace look completely insane in that Harry was desperately trying to make appointments to see his grandmother and his father. First of all, trying to make an appointment with your grandmother and father, hilarious. And that wasn't even happening. He was trying to do something and the palace was just putting up locked doors, essentially. And so in the end, they just used their Instagram to make this statement. And I think that's another part of this story, in that the royals are no longer dependent on the media. The royals can communicate directly what they want to say without having to suck up to people like Richard Kay, as Diana did back in her day, or in this case, Piers Morgan. They can do what they want.
But, and this is the big but, I mean, they talk about trying to slowly get to financial independence. Mm-hmm. I mean, you told us how much she earned for being an actress in Suits. He's inherited millions. I mean, you know, this is the sort of story that everyone's talking about. I mean, I was chatting to my mum and she was like, you know, they want to live in their palace still. And I said, oh, it's Frogmore Cottage. And she went, it's not a cottage, Anoushka. I tell you what, it's not a cottage. It's nicer than that. It costs £2 million. Why should we continue paying for them if they want to quit?
Well, the question is, first of all, how much are we going to continue paying for them? That's what's being hammered out. And secondly, they are still royals. I don't think on the one hand we can be outraged that royals want to quit the family and then be outraged that they're still going to get some benefits. They're not really quitting. They're still who they are.
Isn't there a sense that the Queen
has been disrespected.
Exactly. Even if no one else in the royal family demands respect in that way, there is a bit of a sense, particularly here in the UK, that the Queen is on another level.
Yes, but also none of us actually know how the Queen feels. We're just reliant on rather dubious articles in the tabloids. For all we know, she feels fine about it. I mean, she's the one who wanted the slimmed down monarchy. So
she did say she'd had a bumpy year in the Queen's speech.
But this was before this, though. I mean, who knows? I mean, the bumpy year, one would hope, would refer to Andrew.
I mean, tell me about Andrew. This is a crisis for the royals. It comes after the year of the most extraordinary crisis.
It is completely outrageous that this announcement from Harry and Meghan is prompting more anger and coverage than anything about Andrew. Prince Andrew, openly admits he was palling around with someone who'd been convicted for sex crimes, and B, is accused himself.
One of Epstein's accusers, Virginia Roberts, yeah, has made allegations against you.
And yet there was so little coverage of that, to the point of non-existence, until he gave his interview on Newsnight last year.
She went on to have sex with you in a house in Belgravia belonging to Ghislaine Maxwell, your friend. Your response?
I have no recollection of ever meeting this lady. None whatsoever.
People talk about the Queen wanting to modernise. Meghan clearly wanted the royal family to modernise. But we still hear so much about royal protocol. I mean, one quite telling anecdote I read over the weekend was that Meghan had asked staff not to call her mom, but to call her Meghan. And someone had replied, sorry, we can't really handle that. I mean, is it impossible for the royal family to modernise?
Well, only according to these ridiculous old farts like Dickie Arbiter, who's always ready with a quote in the press saying what Diana would have wanted or what Queen would have wanted or what Queen Victoria would have wanted. Of course, it's not impossible. I think Harry and William were kind of modernizing the royal family before they apparently fell out, talking about mental health, being very open about how their mother's death affected them. That was modernizing the royal family, and people loved them for it. And I think this could modernize the royal family. Great. Let Harry and Meghan go off to North America, go to Los Angeles, where her mother lives, wherever they want to go. There, you know, they're not going to be Kardashians.
The Queen seems to want to get this shut down as quickly as possible, and in a way that doesn't seem vindictive towards Meghan and Harry. I mean, if there is a kind of slimmed down family at the end of this, what do you make of the members who will be left?
I'm sure the Queen's vision of the slimmed down royal family did include Harry. But I also imagine once Harry had his child, he thought, well, where's my child going to fit into this? That's not fitting into the slimmed down royal family. That probably spurred him on to leave, to give Archie a chance to grow up and not just be another Princess Beatrice. So where does that leave the ones who are left? Well, they look a bit old and stuffy, really. Was anybody thrilled when that photo was released over Christmas of the Queen, Charles, William, and George? If it didn't look so much like a promise of a great new land as a threat, like this is who we're stuck with for the next century, the Queen, Charles, William, and George.
Hadley, thank you very much. Oh,
thank you.
That was Hadley Freeman, who has written all about this. Do look up her articles. Coming up, the Trump administration makes a threat over Huawei. Now, the government's decision over whether to develop Britain's 5G network with Huawei, the Chinese telecoms company, is under even more pressure following an unprecedented intervention from a US delegation. On Monday night, American officials warned UK journalists that the US might have to withhold sharing intelligence with the UK if Britain decides to work with the Chinese company. The Guardian's defence and security editor Dan Sabber was among those briefed.
Now, this is a row that's been bubbling off and on for a year now. The Americans sent over a high-powered delegation, senior administration officials, deputy national security advisor, over to Britain to deliver a fresh warning about Huawei. There are new technical risks. They won't tell us what they are. It would be an act of madness for Britain to adopt Huawei technology that the much vaunted intelligence sharing relationship between the UK and the US might be at risk in the medium term if we did so. Real worries about the possibility for surveillance on individuals and companies, they said, couldn't get more alarmist. All this, of course, they provide into a handy briefing to journalists, no more than minutes after, actually, I think their last meeting with ministers in the British government. Normally, if you're going to come over and lobby hard about something, you might do so in private, but you keep your counsel in public. But no, this is the Trump administration and this is how they roll. Maximum pressure in public. This is the new form of lobbying and we better get used to it. So Britain's taken a different view about Huawei to the United States until now. On balance, the prevailing view in the intelligence community is that, yeah, there might be risks from Huawei, we don't know, but we can contain them and manage them. You know, Huawei technology has been used in 3G and 4G mobile for some time. There's this special unit affiliated to part of GCHQ, the intelligence agency, dubbed the Cell. It looks at Huawei code and reviews it and makes sure there are no secret surveillance devices, if you will, contained within it. Mostly they find the code has got mistakes or not very good and they endeavour to make sure it's corrected. But insofar as a sort of secret surveillance problem, none so far has been discovered. Huawei is a Chinese company, it's independent of the state, but could be subject to pressure by the Chinese state to act in a way it doesn't want to. I think it's logically possible it's true of any company around the world in any country in a way. So there might be a theoretical risk, but there isn't a practical one. The Americans, however, seem to see it differently. It should be said, Huawei denies all this, right? Huawei says there is no secret surveillance, there are no backdoors, trapdoors, anything like that in its technology. What the US alleges are there are Huawei employees who simultaneously work for the PLA, People's Liberation Army, and Huawei. And they also allege that Huawei technology has been used as part of the broader suppression of the Uyghurs, the Muslim minority in the west of China. Now, some of this is probably about trade, actually, because the US and China are trade rivals. That's how Donald Trump likes to see the world. And so whilst the Americans dress it up as a security concern, a lot of the British view is actually not really a security concern. It's a trade concern. And what we're really doing is getting caught up in a trade war. Well, that might be true, too. But this is the world in which we live. Britain's coming out of the European Union. From February the 1st, we're going to try and negotiate a trade deal with the United States. The United States wants to drag us closer to its orbit. But there's a price for that, which is doing what they say, and Huawei is one of the first examples. Well, Boris Johnson tried to equivocate. Look, he's got a decision to take, and he's got to get the advice on the table. And he said two things, really. Firstly, those of us who tell us we can't use Huawei, tell us what the alternative is.
Now, if people oppose one brand or another, then they have to tell us which is what's the alternative. Right.
Well, there is an alternative. There's Nokia and Ericsson, Finland and Sweden, respectively, been in the market a long time. But they've slightly lost their way, and Huawei is deemed to be a bit ahead in 5G. And so the view of the Treasury, and indeed the phone companies, is it would be more expensive for British consumers if Huawei is not in the 5G mix, and it would take longer to roll out. The second thing he said, though, was I don't want to jeopardise that intelligence-sharing relationship.
On the other hand, let's be clear, I don't want, as the UK Prime Minister, to put in any infrastructure that is going to prejudice our national security or our ability to cooperate with Five Eyes intelligence partners.
I think he's really got to take a cold and hard view as to when the US threatens that it could be at risk, whether they mean what they say. That's got to be a worry for him. My suspicion is that the US pressure will lead to the UK drifting in the direction of rolling over and complying with the United States over Huawei.
That was Dan Saber. Do follow his reporting on this story on the website. That's it for today. My thanks to Hadley Freeman and Dan Saber. Today's episode was produced by Elizabeth Cassin and Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Axel Cocoutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. Thank you for all the lovely reviews, and a particular thanks for everyone who's given us 5 stars where they listen to their podcasts. It's much appreciated. See you tomorrow.